MSP, and you're listening to Do It Yourself Mama, a special program for International Women's Day on KPFA 94.1 with Sharon Sabota.
Being a mama on your own takes rhythm. Rhythm represents the heart, something that pumps out life and love, much like moms do. But for those of us who are doing it alone, it can be hard to keep the beat. I'm Sharon Sabota, the producer and host of this special International Women's Day show, Do It Yourself Mama. Coming up,
you go from being with your child 100% of the time to all of a sudden you go to 50%. And then on top of that, I had to find a job, and I had been out of the workforce for 5 years.
I'm a warden at the court. So when we get in arguments or whatever, he get mad and he be like, if you ever leave me, don't put our kids in a system like you was in a system.
Felt very, very lonely. I also, at the same time, I felt that this baby is going to be my support.
We had been married for 18 years and had been trying to have a baby for 13 of those 18 years and then finally became pregnant. So about a month after I had my child, my husband just, he found someone else.
I interviewed 7 women for DIY Mama, and today I'm going to bring you 4 of their stories. But first, I'm going to tell you a little bit about mine. My work in radio, much like my work as a mom, is heart work. I call heart work something that feeds our soul, gives us purpose, even if it doesn't help us make ends meet. For my day job, I run a Center for Women and Gender Equity, which means that for my kids, March, which is also Women's History Month and the time in which International Women's Day falls, is a time of chaos. That's why I'm recording portions of today's show in my makeshift studio in my car before the sun comes up. Our story in a nutshell begins in 2011 when I get pregnant with my first daughter, Esperanza, who I call Espy. My daughter's dad moves in a few months before she's born, and he moves back out again when she's 2 years old. That's when I learn that I'm pregnant with Delilah, my second child. I'm alone in California without any family in state, and frankly, I don't know how or if I can pull off being a mom of 2 on my own. As I'm weighing out my options, I take Espy with me to my appointments at Planned Parenthood and at Kaiser because I don't have anyone to watch her. When I'm making my decision about what to do and the doctor squirts jelly on my belly, Espy's with me, and she points at the screen and tells me, "Look, I see a dolly in your tummy," she says. "Look, Mom, it's right there." I ask her what she thinks about, and she just says, "Good." I should mention that in between my 2 pregnancies, I became a doula because, like many women, when I gave birth my first time, I was told to hold my breath and be quiet. And frankly, that is not possible for an unmedicated birthing mom. I thought I was becoming a doula so that I could empower other women. But in the process, I'm also empowering myself and hopefully teaching my daughters how to be the heroes of their own stories. My girls know KPFA, they know rallies. My 5-year-old is excited about politics.
Hello, my name's Lyle Quinn, and Bernie's trying to keep us safe and make us help us go to the doctors again. And he wants to help families. And yeah, do you know Vice President? Because he wants to take care of us.
My 8-year-old is finding her voice, and she loves making videos and singing for her sister.
Hi, my name's Espy. I'm going to be singing a song called Brave, and why I'm going to sing it is because it's about standing up for yourself and being brave so no one can bully you. And it's by Sarah Bareilles, and I'm going to start.
Okay.
You can be amazing. You can turn crazy.
Even if her sister isn't always into it.
You can be the outcast, be the backlash of somebody.
Our lives, well, they're a little chaotic sometimes. When I'm out with my daughters who are mixed, I've been asked if I'm the au pair or the nanny. I've been told that my daughter's name means hope, and I tell them that I know because I'm her mom and I named her. I've been told that they didn't know because they didn't see a ring or they didn't realize I was married or divorced. And I tell them that I'm none of these things. I never have been. And according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, my children are among the 40% born to unmarried mothers. My humble apartment is among the 15 million households in the United States headed by single women. The stories I'm going to bring you in Do It Yourself Mama belong to women whose lives have interfaced with mine. Women who have taken to heart the question, that Me Too founder Tarana Burke posed in an interview. How do you take what you have and make what you need? Each of them come from vastly different life circumstances. I'm Sharon Sabota, and I'm your host and producer for this special International Women's Day edition of Do It Yourself Mama on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. In the first segment, I walk around the neighborhood with Echo Aoki as she describes how vastly different the life she is living is from the one she had planned.
I have a daughter who's 8 years old and she's in second grade. And I'm also a single mom.
Echo Aoki, the daughter of the late Benihana founder Rocky Aoki, always hoped to be a stay-at-home mom.
When I got married, I spoke about my desire to be a stay-at-home mom.
She was, at first.
He was fine with that, and so we progressed, and we got married and had a child. And then a few years later, there were some infidelities, and then we split, and all of a sudden I was thrust into this new life where I was a single mom. It just seemed unfair. You know, when you're a stay-at-home mom, you go from being with your child 100% of the time to all of a sudden you go to 50%. And then on top of that, I had to find a job. And I had been out of the workforce for 5 years. And before that, I had been working with my family in Hawaii. So my work history was not as strong as many women that are still working and maintaining a marriage and children and also a job at the same time. Whereas I was just a stay-at-home mom and I didn't have a strong work history at that point. So it was a very, very scary time for me.
At first, she wanted to be near her own mother.
I moved back to my home in L.A., but then I was served an ex parte where I had to come back. And all of a sudden, I had no place to live. The court didn't grant me being able to live back in our own home, and so I was literally homeless.
When Echo lost her house, a friend of a friend opened her humble two-bed, one-bath apartment to her.
She was a single mom as well. She was so gracious. She opened up her house and let me and Bella stay there and live with her for a few months while we were getting back on our feet. Her two children, one was an infant and one was 3 years old, same age as my daughter, actually. That was really nice because on the days where I didn't have my daughter and I could see another three-year-old running around, I just felt less alone. You know, being a stay-at-home mom and then having your child not with you for long stretches of time is just really heartbreaking. It's really hard to get used to that. And everyone used to say to me, you got to reframe it. You got to change how you perceive it. Look, you have more time to yourself. But I had gone from having my daughter as like my main focal point and making sure she's safe, making sure she's fed, making sure she's growing and being educated to all of a sudden she's not in my realm anymore. I don't even know what's happening to her. I'd have been so much more lonely if I had been alone by myself.
You started out the interview by saying that you are the daughter of Rocky Aoki, who founded Benihana.
Maybe people don't know Benihana or even know that name. I like to underplay that. I'm not running around saying, hey, I'm this, I'm that. But I did grow up in a certain way. Like, my family traveled a lot. You know, we lived in a house. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad was a busy entrepreneur. You know, I saw him on holidays, and he was a strong influence in my life. But I didn't have a lot of the stressors that most people have because, you know, my family did have money, and my dad did take care of a lot of things for us, like our education and, you know, our food and stuff like that. So I didn't have that struggle to work like three jobs to survive. And now I feel like, you know, my dad's no longer with us on this earth, so he's not there to protect me.
Echo worked hard to get a job.
I had some great female friends rallied to help me figure out how to put a resume together. You know, we go over interview questions, all that stuff. I mean, I feel like I actually am a great employee. I just hadn't had the confidence. It's funny because I found out I was selected out of 10 people, and I've been working there ever since, 5 years now.
What type of work?
I do accountings.
Echo learned quickly that she wouldn't be able to count on child support.
When I went into court, I was going to be awarded $17 in child support, 1-7. And I remember asking my ex, like, do you think that's fair? He said he thought that was fair. And I was like, I just realized at that moment, there was no way to get ahead except for on my own gusto, right?
Unlike the others in this piece, Eka was born into a family that had money. She started off with a savings account. But even that and her job wasn't enough to sustain her.
And so I had to downsize. I had to move to a smaller apartment. And then I had to move to another smaller apartment. And so in the back of my head, I've lived in great big mansions. I've lived in a house in Orinda. And now I'm living in a two-bedroom and then now a smaller two-bedroom. And I was just like depressed because I kept thinking, oh, I'm getting downsized. When is my life going to be upsized? You know what I mean? Is it ever going to be? But then I realized maybe this is the exercise, like in living small.
Eka says her experience taught her the hard way what resilience and independence looks like. And she wants to inspire her own daughter to carry those traits forward.
Now that I've gone through this, I am teaching my child, my daughter, more self-reliance, more, hey, you can do this, be prepared for this, be ready to change a tire, be ready to do this, be ready to do that. Things that help her. I mean, she's not changing a tire right now, but I will like help her learn those things because I don't want her to be without those skill sets.
Hi, I'm SP, and you're listening to Do It Yourself Mama, a special program for International Women's Day on KPFA 94.1 with Sharon Sabota. Stay tuned.
My name is Shamika. I have three children. Seth is 9, Victoria is 7, and Legend is 1.
Shamika is a catering supervisor at St. Mary's College where I work. She shares her story with me over a matcha tea during her lunch break.
I'm a former foster child. My grandmother raised me. My biological mother wasn't around. She was on drugs. So growing up, I thought my grandmother and my grandfather was my mom. I didn't want my children like to come from like a single parent house at first, you know, because I just thought like, okay, I didn't have both parents. I didn't even have one. So I wanted them to have like both. But I feel like now, as time progresses, at least they have one, like I'm there, even though like me and the father's not together, they have me.
Shamika remembers her first pregnancy.
I was 25, living in Stockton. It was scary. I was going to school, San Joaquin Delta College at the time, living on my own. And I was like, okay, I gotta get a real job because I was just going to school. So just like, you know, now I had like somebody else to think about. So I stopped going to school and I started working here at St. Mary's for Sodexo. Nothing could ever like explain like what you go through when you have contractions, because I think I was at like 6 centimeters, or not even 6, like 4. And I thought I was like at 8 or 9. It was like, no, you only at 4. I was like, yeah, give me that epidural.
With Shamika's baby being the firstborn in the family, her delivery was a big deal.
I was in labor for like over 24 hours, so, and I still delivered him regularly. He was in ICU for like 3 days. I think that was like the hardest thing ever because I cried. I was like, what's wrong with my baby? What did I do?
And who was with you?
My biological mother was there at the time. My grandma, my auntie, the children's father, like it was like a whole room full of people.
Shamika's biological mom hadn't been there for her when she was growing up. But she was there that day when Shamika birthed her child. Shamika's baby went to NICU soon after being born, and he was there for several days. She says having her birth mom with her at that time really mattered.
I was glad she was there. She was nervous as heck.
And has she stayed in your life?
In and out. In and out.
Shamika says that to this day, her relationship with her biological mom impacts the way she shows up as a mom for her own kids.
I had this conversation more than once with her about how I felt abandoned when I was younger, how she left us and she wasn't there for us. It wasn't okay. You know, like everybody else had a mom and I'm looking for a mom and she wasn't there. Like I got letters from jail and cards like full of empty promises. And now that I'm older, you know, it's like the same thing, which she's not in jail and there's nothing stopping. So why not follow through with your promises? That being said, like with my children, I just want them to know like, okay, it's nothing that y'all doing. Because at first when I was growing up, like I thought it was like me, you know, it's like, why she's not there? It's like, is it she didn't want me? Was I that bad? You know, it's like all this stuff. And it's like, No, so I'm like, you guys, it's nothing that y'all did. There's nothing wrong with you guys. Just, she's not ready. Everybody will change, you know, in their day. Like, we'll just, hopefully it's before, you know, it's too late.
Shamika says that she thought she was doing the best she could to make her relationship with the father of her children work for the sake of her kids.
I want to say, like, our relationship always been, like, rocky and up and down. This last time when I was pregnant with my youngest Legend, we had actually broken up and we got back together, and he made promises that he was going to do better and everything and treat me better, which he didn't, because I went through like a lot of verbal abuse through the whole relationship.
Shamika's partner used what she'd shared with him about her past against her.
I'm a warden of the court, so I couldn't find him because, like, we was together on and off for, like, over 9 years. When we get in arguments or whatever, he get mad and he'd be like, yeah, you know, you're going to, if you ever leave me, don't put our kids in a system like you was in a system. And, you know, it's like, you're going to do this to your children where they're not going to have both family, you know, mother and father, because you grew up not having that. That's not fair for them.
Shamika eventually kicked her children's father out.
The reason why I kicked him out was he wasn't working. I'm working my tail off doing doubles and all this other stuff, working even with the kids. You know, they get sick. I'm up with the kids when they're sick and everything, getting their clothes ready. And then he's just at home playing video games, smoking weed, and just, like, chilling at home. I'm, like, busting my tail off to, like, make sure everything's staying afloat.
Shamika says that she and her children's father had an on-again-off-again relationship. Shortly before she got pregnant with her youngest son, she gave her children's father a chance. He was going to get a job. He promised things would be different, that he would treat her better this time. But, like the promises her mom made in childhood, they turned out to be empty. One night after a heated fight, Shamika had several drinks and went to bed with the intention of sleeping them off.
I had no intentions on going nowhere. Like, I was like, oh, whatever, you know, hey, I could sleep in the next day. Like, it's fine. Like,
the next day, before the sun rose, Shamika's then-boyfriend woke her up because he needed a ride.
He drove himself to the bus stop, went to work, and then let me get behind the wheel. And I don't remember even getting behind the wheel, to be honest. I just woke up and the police was there.
So you had an accident.
I drove into a ditch.
Shamika regrets getting behind the wheel that morning.
But as I was, like, sobered up in the holding cell, the first thing came to my mind was my children. Like, I just started panicking and was so nervous about my children. Like, that's all I could think about. My neighbor, Miss Ray, she was able to come pick me up. Ever since then, like, he'll hold my DUI against me. Like, oh yeah, you got the DUI. Like, you're an alcoholic and, you know, you shouldn't be driving. But I just feel like the whole time, like, who in their right mind will let somebody drive like that?
Soon after, Shamika and her kid's father broke up again, but stayed in the same house.
We were supposed to be, like, roommates, I guess, in a way, where I'm like, hey, I paid my half of the rent, you pay your half of the rent, like, that's how it's going to be. Like, we just going to be housemates for the time being. Just before I had my son, I found out he wasn't paying his half of the rent. So we got kicked out our place. So that was, like, nerve-wracking because, again, like, as a mom, you want to, like, provide for your children and be there. And I felt like I was failing my kids, like, just in every way. Like, I am not a good role model. Like, I got DUI, like, you know, that's not a good role model because anything could happen. And we lost our place. So I don't got a DUI, don't have a car. So it was a transport.
Don't have a home now.
Right, don't have a home. You know, like, I didn't know where we was going to go at first. Like, I'm calling, like, everybody I knew. Like, oh, well, can I stay here with you? Can I stay there? And also thinking about, like, I still got to go to work. But luckily, the children's father and mother said we could stay there. And it was only supposed to be for, like, a couple of months, but it ended up being, like, 6 months or so that I stayed there. I'm still struggling. I still don't have my own place. I'm living with family. We stay in a three-bedroom apartment.
And how many people live in the three-bedroom?
It's my auntie, my two cousins, one of their child, my grandmother, me, and my three children, so Nine people
in a three-bedroom.
In a three-bedroom, two-bathroom, so it's kind of crammed in there. My room slash the children room is the living room. Like, we have to make ends meet. We're splitting rent, like, three ways. Rent is $23.50, so it's, like, it's expensive. Like, I was trying to find a place on my own, and I just couldn't afford it. On a positive note, they do help with my children. My grandmother, she watched my youngest child, Legend, because before I went back to work, I was looking at the cost of daycare, and that's expensive. It's like almost $500 a week, and I can't afford that. That's all I make within a week, so it's like, you know, if I pay that, then I would seriously have nothing at all.
In July 2019, Shamika realized she needed financial help that she could count on.
When we broke off the first time, we tried to do like a verbal agreement about it, and he wouldn't always come through. It's like, oh, well, I don't have the money this time, or oh, I only could give you this much. So this time, I'm like, okay, I need help, and I just went for child support. And he found out I was going for child support, so he went to court to get custody.
So you use the system that's in place to help people like you, right? So that you can make ends meet and take care of your children. And then, rather than helping support you financially, he tries to get custody taken away from you?
Yes, and we went to court, and they actually granted him joint custody. So we have joint custody now. And after I found that out, I was still checking on my child support case, and they told me if I actually went through with child support, since he don't work, I will actually end up paying him child support. And he don't work because he don't want to. There's nothing like physically wrong with him or anything like that. He just don't work because he don't want to. So I actually had to close my case, and I'm paying everything, like medical, all their hygiene, just everything that they need, clothes, like, I'm paying for that on my own.
Do you feel like the system failed you?
Actually, I do. I really do. I do. I feel like it's not fair.
The court will say children are entitled to child support. They deserve it. This is money that's for them, and we can't deny it from the children. But it's a double-edged sword because, well, this is true. When the parent asks for it so often, the other parent will say, well, let me just adjust the custody share then. And then maybe all of a sudden mom goes from having the kids 100% of the time to now 50%.
At first it was hard for me because I'm nursing my youngest son, and I'm still nursing. I told the judge, like, I plan on nursing him to like the age of two. They told me it's not a necessity. He can have regular milk or whatever, but it's like, it's the bonding, it's everything. Like, how are you going to just tear away a child like that? And that's nursing, like the emotional, just everything. Like, it was very hard at first. It was hard because I construct my whole life around them. Like, everything. So when it first happened, like, I cried. I cried because, again, like, they've been around me, like, all the time. And now I get them either 2 days or, you know, it's like 5 days. So.
Or some percentage of the time. How do you feel about that whole thing?
I don't really think they think about the kids like that because they're actually hurting them. From my experience, what's going on right now, the father have joint custody and he's not even providing like half the stuff that they really need. You know, again, like, he just did it to get out of child support. So it's like, I don't think they really look at all aspects.
You know, the day that you got the verdict and you found out at least that you had 50%, right? Because he was trying to get them taken all the way away.
Yeah.
So that day you were completely devastated. Where are you today and what's gotten you through?
Today, I'm doing better with it. At first, everybody's like, oh, you could have more me time. I'm like, no, I don't want me time. I want my babies. Like, but I took that in consideration, and I'm doing more positive stuff, and I'm actually am doing more me time. I started going back to school, trying to get my degree right now. I'm taking statistics, so I'm doing good in that. And I just cherish the time that they're with me.
What would you say to another person who's facing the same struggle?
As long as you have like a good support system, people you could talk to and rely on, because I feel like that's what got me through, because it's still times where I'm struggling and going through it with my children, father, and everything. And I just have people that I could talk to and just, you know, keep me calm and collective and keep me looking at the bright side, because it's hard. It's really hard. And if you don't have that type of support or those people, I feel like you're going to really spiral down.
What's the most important lesson you learned from having to go through this journey that you didn't pick at all? And also, what lessons do you want to impart onto your kids?
So now what I'm doing, my whole little journey is about me. I'm not going to rush into another relationship. Also, with my children father, like, I'm learning with him. I got to document everything. Just keep documenting everything. And for them, you know, I just want them to see about, like, self-love and how you're supposed to love yourself and how to be a better person.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and I'm your host and producer for this special International Women's Day edition of Do-It-Yourself Mama on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org.
My name is Sunita Shastri. I'm 40 years old. I'm a preschool teacher in Moraga, California. I have two boys, 7 and 4. I came to U.S. after I got married when I was 28 years old. And this year I will be divorcing.
It's 9 p.m. Sunita's boys are asleep, so now she has time to talk. She crushes spices and prepares 2 cups of chai.
Most of this stuff I learned from my dad.
Because your mom passed away so young?
Yeah, by the time I started learning to cook, she had already passed away.
Sunita's journey into motherhood began with an arranged marriage, a process that started shortly after her mother's untimely death.
Basically, my mom was very, very strong support for all of us, including my dad, my brothers, and myself. So her death came as a shock for all of us. I was very free-minded when she was alive. Like, I used to think, oh, she's there to take care of everything. So the only thing I did was planning my career, my goals, achieving my master's, which didn't happen because I had to discontinue after she died suddenly.
A few days after the interview, Sunita reveals that her mother took her own life, that it was Sunita who found her. Sunita suspended her studies in medical school to care for her family, and with her dad's help, found someone she thought would be a suitable husband. Her future husband was working in the U.S. at the time while she was in India.
His family, his uncle, aunt, and his mom came with the ring and priest, and all that auspicious engagement happened with him being online, but not him being present personally. And then next day after engagement, he called me up and said that, I don't think we are going ahead with the proposal and I want to break the engagement. And I asked him the reason, and he gave many reasons. He said that his uncle and aunt didn't like our house. We lived in India because it was a 2-bedroom apartment and it's a small house. Then his mom said that we belong to a lower caste and she's dark and she's not beautiful.
You said that had your mom been alive, she might have advocated for you and she might have said, forget about the marriage. Talk about like how the death of your mom when you were 24, how that really impacted you and kind of your transition into marriage and motherhood and all of those things.
So if she was alive, I always think that she would have said, who cares if they're breaking the engagement? It's okay. She would have said that you can live your life. She was that kind of a woman.
In the end, you get married. And then what does it look like, your transition from home to your then husband's home?
I was nervous because it was like stranger for me.
She had never been away from home.
All of a sudden, getting married in 2 days and then going to a stranger's house and completely to a different state, where I didn't know the language at also, and to a house where I didn't know how they lived, their lifestyle. And when I went there, I was always scared. Even if I wanted to eat something, if I was hungry, I was scared to ask.
She had never dated or had any type of relationship, let alone sex.
The entire family decides about it. and they ask to dress up in a particular color. Then they book a hotel and they tell the hotel people that it's wedding night. So it was all awkward because when I stepped in, everybody in the hotel, the staff and everybody knows, oh, this couple is going to have sex tonight. Growing up, there was no dating. I was not supposed to have a boyfriend or anything, that kind of culture. So this was my first time having intimacy, but it was not intimacy. It's just not even asking how you're feeling. Are you nervous or do you need some time? It was just that undress and just, I felt like a doll, like lifeless.
Sunita hadn't yet learned how to cook, which turned out to be a big problem for her mother-in-law.
The mother-in-law started saying, didn't your mother teach you anything? I mean, you're a girl, you should know cooking. You don't know even to make a cup of tea. Whenever she used to cook lunch, she used to make me chop everything. And then when I used to stand and watch her cooking, she used to just go on like, my mom was dead and she used to just talk about my mom, that she didn't teach me anything, and that just felt very disrespectful.
So marriage, it sounds like, even though there's a lot of people around, it sounds like it was lonely.
It was very lonely, and it never felt like my house or my family. I felt like not even like a guest, it was more like a maid.
She had high hopes that life in the U.S. would be better for her.
When I was coming to U.S., I had hopes that I will fall in love with my husband and I will experience all those things, but it didn't happen.
Sunita was clear that she wanted to be a mom, but that was not an easy journey either.
I had two miscarriages before my first one, but I was blamed for it. I was told that there's something wrong in your body. Every time I wanted to cry, I didn't cry, and that is the worst thing I did, because I didn't realize eventually I was slipping into depression.
When Sunita got pregnant with her oldest son, she was too scared to be excited. And then her mother-in-law came to help. Well, at least that's what she said, shortly before the child was born. But the relationship between the two of them was strained.
Even if I was 10 or 15 minutes late to cook rice, she used to yell at me. And she used to say, what if your mother was alive, you used to give her late food?
Sunita's contractions started just before midnight when she went into labor.
Early morning, 6 o'clock, the cramps started getting so severe. Then I went to my husband and I was waking him up. And I said, I'm getting cramps. And then my mother-in-law came and said, why are you waking him up? If you're getting cramps, you can just call the doctor, she said. Still, my mother-in-law didn't hold my hand, or she didn't say, it's okay, everything will be fine. That was the time I missed my mom terribly. Like, I felt very, very lonely. I also, at the same time, I felt that this baby is going to be my support, because until then, I was very lonely.
Her mother-in-law's presence in the delivery room only made it more difficult.
Before I could deliver, she was like, hold it for 5 minutes, hold it for 10 minutes. This is the auspicious time.
Sunita's mother-in-law believed the child was unlucky because he wasn't born at the auspicious time.
She didn't touch him for 2 or 3 weeks until the priest confirmed that he was born at the right time.
Her husband hesitated from touching his own son because he said the child was too dark and looked too much like his mother.
My elder one was not a fair-skinned baby, so their father didn't hold him or touch him for 3 months. He used to say, take him away and go. He looks like you. He's ugly. And the mother-in-law used to convince, it's okay even if he's dark, he's handsome. But I was thinking that a father doesn't need to be convinced like a kindergarten kid that way. He touched his son after 3 months because when we started taking him out, everybody used to tell, oh, he has beautiful eyes, he's very beautiful. That is when he changed his mind. Oh, my son is beautiful even though he's brown.
Her mother-in-law stayed after the child was born.
My mother-in-law used to cook only for her and her son. And when I used to go to the dining table, she used to say, whatever is remaining is yours. If you want to eat, you eat, or just throw it in the trash.
You're getting the scraps.
Yeah. And then she used to say, you know, he works, he earns money, so he should be eating good.
Sunita's mother-in-law reminded her frequently that she was from a lower caste, something she would have been willing to overlook if Sunita had been able to practice medicine in the U.S.
They were looking for a doctor or someone to come to the U.S. and earn.
But without time to study for her exams, that never happened.
Their condition was, I have to read for the exam and do all the other household work, and there was no support at all.
Sunitha was starting to think that she wouldn't have much of a life here. Then about a year ago, her husband got a job in Minneapolis, which turned out to be a blessing in disguise for Sunitha and her children.
He thought that we'll join him in Minneapolis. Then I was still scared to say we are not going to join him, but I made excuse like the older one is still in school, and when he'll finish his first grade, maybe we'll shift there. But after first grade, I just told him that, you know, let's continue the second grade here because he's already made friends. And so I tried very hard to find a job until then so that I can give him the excuse that now I found a job, I don't want to come there.
Sunitha's husband had given her a credit card to cover expenses related to the children, but he monitored it closely.
I used it in the farmer's market once, so he didn't get a clear, he didn't understand from where the transaction was. So he called me, he calls me to confirm it. What did you do with that? I mean, what did you buy at the farmer's market?
Sunitha's husband covered the rent of their two-bedroom apartment, but since he and his mom were no longer living there, Sunitha and her children had to downsize to a one-bedroom. When she moved, she tried but failed to put the lease in her own name.
Yeah, lease was because I don't have any savings in my name in as a bank account, and I have to show them a balance of $8,000 if my name has to be in the lease.
And how many people have $8,000 in their bank account right now? Like, so then you move to the single bedroom apartment and you have your two boys that you're taking care of, and you don't have work. You have never had the experience of working in this country, and you're living kind of at his mercy. Yeah. Talk about some of the steps that you took to, you know, try to get on your feet.
I was applying everywhere, but everybody said that I didn't have any work experience. I was not allowed to make friends when he was here, so I didn't have any friends, and I was not even allowed to touch his laptop.
Slowly but surely, Sunitha broke her silence about her strained relationship with her husband and mother-in-law and started connecting with friends, pulling herself out of isolation, one conversation at a time. And then she got connected with the Contra Costa County Family Justice Center.
Yeah, we went to the Family Justice Center, and then I was really surprised and shocked all the services they provide and what all I have the rights in this marriage. I didn't know about that.
And you got access to food stamps, which was a lifesaver because...
Yeah, at that time it was, even now it is. Because one of my main concerns was how will I provide them with food if he suddenly stops paying once I file for divorce. And one more concern was the rent. Because once I file for divorce, the first thing he will do is take his name off of the lease and stop paying rent.
As Sunitha considered job options, she realized the one type of experience she did have was childcare. As context for listeners, Sunitha and I both have children at Lafayette Elementary School, and with both of our families far away, we help each other out. One day on our way back from a less than satisfactory job interview, we got a call that connected Sunitha to a job as a preschool teacher in Moraga.
One of the school directors, who is Sharon's friend, messaged her saying that, hey, we are in need of a preschool teacher aide and we'll be paying her really good, and if you know someone. And then she immediately called him and said, I know one of the friend who is looking for a job.
She's in my car,
and we can have the interview in the afternoon at the coffee place. And then he took my interview and he gave me the job only based on the experience that I helped my friends to take care of their kids after school.
This job paid $19 an hour with benefits.
With benefits, and they offered
and schooling.
A free place for my younger one in pre-K. He's going there for free.
Making a difference for small children has changed Sunitha's life. And getting a paycheck has given her a sense of independence. Talk about like the logistics, like how do you piece it together to take care of your kids, and what does your support community look like?
I help my friends to take care of their kid, and they help me to drive to work or drive to grocery store. They're also sometimes, they're also helping me to learn how to drive, practice driving.
Sunitha says that breaking her silence was what she had to do to set herself free.
I want to give a message to anybody who has gone through abusive, any kind of relationship, whether it's marriage or not marriage or whatever, is that we shouldn't be embarrassed to talk about it. That's what I went through. I was very embarrassed to talk about it. And once I started opening up, I started realizing there's so much help around you. And there's so much of information that we don't know that's available. And there are people who are there to help you. Yeah.
So basically, once you started talking, that's how you started to connect with resources and pull yourself out.
I was in Lafayette for, I'm in Lafayette for 2 years now, since my elder one started kindergarten. But every time I went to school, it was like putting a fake smile and pretend smile and to show people that everything is okay. But it doesn't help in the long run. And then I had to open up to someone. And when the physical abuse happened, I opened up to one friend and it led to another. And then that led to the circle of help and community help.
And the most important lesson she learned was to count on herself, no matter what anyone says.
The most important thing I learned is that the biggest strength is yourself. And you have it in you. You just have to explore it and know it and realize that you can do it. And there's nobody to tell you that you can't do it. And that's what I was told all the time, that you cannot do it. You're a failure. And that's all false.
Hi, I'm SP, and you're listening to Do It Yourself Mama, a special program for International Women's Day on KPFA 94.1 with Sharon Sabota.
In the spirit of ending on a high note, of finding the silver lining in our struggles and unforeseen circumstances, I wanted to close this special International Women's Day edition, Do It Yourself Mama, with the story of a woman whose path crossed mine in a writing class.
Hi, I'm Christine Hyung-Oakley. I live in Berkeley, and I am a writer who has many jobs. So I am primarily known as the author of Tell Me Everything You Don't Remember, which is a memoir about my recovery from stroke at the age of 33. I also write about trauma, recovery from trauma, and the fact that I'm a single mother, how I became a single mother, as well as race and identity through the writing of my about my urban farm, which I do over at Catapult magazine.
My mantra is that when life doesn't go as planned, it's best to embrace it as content at first and then do something about it. So perhaps that's why Christine's story about paving her path to freedom after experiencing postpartum depression and having her husband leave her when her child was less than a year old inspires me so much.
We had been married for 18 years and had been trying to have a baby for 13 of those 18 years and then finally became pregnant. So about a month after I had my child, my husband just, he found someone else. Simultaneously, I had been struggling with postpartum depression, which then became a very complicated depression. I did not know he was stepping out on me because I was just so overwhelmed with motherhood and having a baby. But eventually over the year, you know, he just stopped coming home except on weekends. And it wasn't until my child was about 10 months old that a friend saw him with another woman on the street. And that friend called me. And he was able to get to the bottom of things because I hadn't checked the banking accounts. I hadn't checked anything for 10 months because I was so underwater. And then I found out the bank account had been depleted. I found out that when I looked at the credit card statements that household items had been bought. I tracked down checks and found out that there were checks for rent at another place. And I found out the name of the person with whom he'd begun a relationship. I found all of this out in about 36 hours.
And it's as you're struggling with postpartum. You know,
here's a timeline. Postpartum depression, beginning of year, sleeplessness, not eating, dropping down to high school weight, and just being overwhelmed with a child. And then about 9 months later, I finally admitted that I had postpartum depression. I finally was just like, I have to get help or die. And so I frantically called my doctors all day. by the way, when they say call your doctor when you have postpartum depression,
yeah, let's talk about
they
this.
Don't tell you which doctor to call. So I remember calling my old psychotherapist with whom I've become, you know, like we've maintained a relationship for 25 years.
That's awesome.
And he can't prescribe medicine. So he said, possibly call your child's pediatrician or your primary care physician. So I called my child's pediatrician. They referred me to my OB, my obstetrician. I also called my primary care physician, who told me that they couldn't do anything and to call my OB. So then I called my OB and I said, this is an extreme emergency. You have to get back to me today. And they were able to get back to me, I think, by the end of the day and call a prescription in.
And in that stage of your life, writer was already a major component of your identity, right?
Yes. I had not published a book yet, but I had finished my MFA program and was fully immersed in that identity as a writer. So I discovered my postpartum depression. And then once I got on Zoloft and was in a much better place, then I got the phone call from my friend who told me that he'd seen my husband with someone else on the street. That's when over the next 36 hours, because he was out of town, I said, come home. I will not scream at you. Come home. And then I found out all this information. And then the truth came out. Like, I was pretty devastated. I gave him a month's chance, much to the chagrin of many of my friends. And ultimately, he decided to leave the marriage. And I spent the next several months very, very sad. I chose sadness because I didn't want to hold it in and crystallize it into anger. I thank my child to this day for instilling in me the resolve to act as graciously as I could and to be as healthy as I could to myself. Because if she weren't there, I think that there would have been nothing holding me back from being my most primitive self.
And I mentioned the writing piece and if that was a piece of your identity, because I think there's a misconception that a writer's life is a very glamorous one.
So who has that conception?
People who aren't writers, I
think.
Oh,
no, no. I think it's just because of movies, like in Romancing the Stone. Right. And Kathleen Turner is just pouring out all the pages and just going. And I think that in Stranger Than Fiction, there's a somewhat of a portrait of misery. When I was at a writing residency called Hedgebrook up on Whidbey Island in the Puget Sound, I remember sitting at dinner with other writers. We were laughing, saying, and this is back in the, I think they're still in, when reality shows were a huge thing. And we
right.
said, wouldn't it be funny if we had a reality show here? And then we just started cackling because all it would be is pictures of us like scratching our heads, staring at our screens. It's very tedious. I often wish that my passion were accounting.
There's 100% job placement.
Yes, there is. And also, like, it's very concrete.
At the same time, I'm super glad that writing is what you have to offer, among other things. The reason I was asking, though, about writing and the kind of the misinformed conception that this is a very glamorous thing, you'd mentioned that you were pregnant after a 13-year marriage. And so in many ways, you probably thought like the life you'd been waiting for should be happening in front of you. And yet it was kind of all falling apart.
It was a really rough start into motherhood for me. I mean, it just was. I mean, I was very, 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 very sad at the time. I was on my best behavior for my child. And one of the things I tried to do was look for the lessons.
And what were some of the lessons that you were able to?
I couldn't find any in the experience, but then it was then that I was able to see my stroke with clarity. I had been struggling to write about my stroke for quite some time because I had my stroke on December 31, 2006. So let's call it 2007 because it was on the last day of 2006.
Let's call it that.
So it had been over 10 years, and it had been just something that happened, but I couldn't make real sense of it. And it wasn't until my husband left me and that everything I recognized in my life had been taken away from me, and everything in my life was absolutely new and something I could barely recognize. Like, my marriage was gone, my job was gone, my financial stability was gone. In its place was a new child, you know, an empty house, you know, Nobody
to support you.
Nobody to support me, an empty bed, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of when I go, I got to hold on to something for strength. I was like, well, I survived a stroke, I guess. And then once I thought of that, I began to see parallels between the two traumas. I began to see the ways in which I had to strategize to recover from my stroke and what I leaned on to get through it. I mean, I leaned heavily on my husband in my stroke recovery, so I credit him that. In the end, like, it was something that I had to navigate. It was a new terrain as well. And I basically had to tell myself, if I survived a stroke, I think I could survive this. And then, of course, from there, you get into more granularity. What was it about the stroke that's helping me survive this? And I started making connections. And it was during that phase of my life that I was finally able to write about the stroke. So I wrote this essay for BuzzFeed, and then that led to a 2-book deal. So all the gates opened up. Because I investigated the lessons from a prior trauma, which then made me open to new experiences and receptive to new opportunities. And then my life opened up again. So, you know, I thought that every single door had closed, you know, and motherhood certainly, especially in the early months, is not one of those makes you feel like you can do anything in the world. Experiences.
True.
It may make you feel strong, but it does not make you feel like liberated or free, at least for those first 6 months. But it so happened to be the setting of this enormous change in my life.
So I always say no struggle, no story. So the silver lining of the demise of the marriage is that it presented an opportunity, one that you wouldn't have chosen, but to look back and really gain clarity about life through this lived experience of a stroke, perhaps?
Yeah. I mean, I've had a few years since my marriage ended now to unpack it.
So that might be another memoir.
Yeah, who knows? In like 20 years, who knows? I now see that time as some greater force telling me, I gave you a stroke and you didn't learn from it. You didn't set yourself free. I literally changed your brain. And you didn't set yourself free. All right, so now I'm going to truly uncage you in the most uncomfortable way and take away everything you know and set you into a new landscape. Now you have no choice but to open your eyes and build yourself a new world. And that's how I see it. It was like, all right, take one didn't do its job. So now here's take two. Now go. And because I had nothing and I had nothing to lose, I decided that year to do everything I could and let go of everything I could do nothing about. So I wasn't able to pay my mortgage. I didn't have a job. I had a new baby. I had postpartum depression and my spouse was not paying support. So I just did what I could, but I knew I could write. And I just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. And that's what happened. Like, well, that led to a 2-book deal.
I'm Sharon Sabota. I've been your host and producer of this special International Women's Day edition called Do It Yourself Mama for KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. You can hear some of my other interviews at sharonksabota.podbean.com. A special thanks to Echo Aoki, Shamika Brown, Sunitha Shastri, Christine Lee, and to my daughters, Delilah and Espy Estrada Sabota. Before I sign off, I want to take a quick moment to wish my niece, Ella Mae Splinter, a very happy 7th birthday. Her birthday is today on International Women's Day. My personal favorite thing about this day and about being a journalist in working in radio is having the opportunity to amplify voices, share multiple truths. So on that note, I'm going to roll us out with this audio montage called Multiple Truths. Again, I'm Sharon Sabota. You're listening to KPFA 94.1 FM, online at kpfa.org. Happy International Women's Day.
La, 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 la. My name is Larry Hunt. They call me the Bucket Man, San Francisco. I'm from Lubbock, Kansas. I've been doing this since I was 3 years old. I'm 58 years old now.
And how did you find your joy in bucket drumming?
Well, I started 3 years old. I'd put my dad's cans and buckets out, and I started playing.
What does that mean to you, the rhythm of change?
The rhythm of change. Everything changed. Nothing stays the same. You got to go rhythm of life.
And how important is rhythm for you?
It's a heartbeat. It keeps me alive.
I'm Winona Wilms, and I'm a screenwriter. What would you say is the most important lesson you've learned on your journey thus far?
To put yourself out there. I started writing when I was 30. For me, it was about giving that to my children. I wanted them to see that no matter where you are, you can pursue your dreams and goals and you can be successful in it.
What possibility do you see in screenwriting for shifting hearts?
We're all humans, so we can connect to other people on a very basic level. Finding universal in our stories, but maintaining our stories and just letting people know we're here.
Tarana Burke. I was living in Selma, Alabama, and it was started as an initiative of an organization I co-founded, Just Be Inc. And it was started to support the black and brown girls in our program who were disclosing experiences with sexual violence. It was also started because I could not figure out why, as a community, we didn't look at sexual violence as a social justice issue.
How did you find your voice?
My voice was always there. I had people who came into my life who helped me figure out how to amplify it. And so I think I've spent the better part of my life making sure that other voices are amplified as well.
My name is Khadija Abdi. I also go by JoJo. I'm a medical interpreter and a writer. The Somali people, in essence, are very strong, very willful, and in essence, they're always building on whatever broken system they have. They manage to build on it, you know. They have really awesome telecommunication system that's, you know, even way ahead of the kind we have here. You know, we've been doing mobile money since the early 2000s. So there's a lot of, they're resilient people, in essence, is what I'm trying to say. You know, we carve a life in a very tough environment that's harsh and drought riddle, but it's also beautiful. It's a story of struggle, but it's hopefully coming back to a story of coming together and rebuilding and recovering. At the end of it, America is it's a nation of immigrants and natives, you know, and each of us, we bring something to what it means to be American, and it's what makes us beautiful and what differentiates us from the rest of the world.
Though I was an activist in the 60s, in the Civil Rights Revolution at the national level, I'm now living in the future that I helped to create. Those people protesting are now of every color, every ethnicity, every economic class. They're marching as Americans. It is an amazing thing to have lived through.
Because you always reinvent yourself, I never end an interview without asking you the most important lesson that you've learned on your journey thus far. So what is it today?
That's easy. There is a place on the film that the National Park Service developed where a Rosie, who lives in Rossmore, and she says that period was the greatest coming together of the American people that she had ever lived through. And when the film was first released to us, I used to stand against the wall and watch the faces of the audience as she uttered those words, and I think, how can Agnes say that? She knows that isn't true. I've got to speak to that woman. And one day, after my 90th birthday, I was suddenly able to hear that that was Agnes's truth, and that there were many truths, that we all create our own reality, and that there are truths that rise out of religious conviction, and they rise out of education, they rise out of life experience, that many of those truths are in conflict, but nonetheless true. And I realized that as long as there was a place on the planet where Agnes's truth and mine could coexist, that that was going to be enough for me from that day forward. And for me, that's the park that I'm working at. And I get to share that insight with the 14-year-olds that come through, which I consider a real privilege. So they don't have to get to be 90 years old before they discover that. That probably is the most important lesson I've learned in the last decade.
The existence of multiple truths.
Yes.
Thank you. This is amazing. Thank you so much.